Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today are retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, the Executive Director of the U.S. Cyberspace Solarium Commission, and Eric Sayers of Beacon Global Strategies. Both worked for the late Senator John McCain, as well as U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, where Mark was the J3. They were the authors of a new paper, Make China the Explicit Priority in the Next NDS, or National Defense Strategy, issued by the Center for a New American Security, one of a series of papers, part of the think tank's The Next Defense Strategy series. I should also have mentioned that the paper that we covered yesterday with Michelle Flournoy and Gabrielle Sheffitz are part of this very same series. Mark and Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Mark, start us off, right? The National Defense Strategy is a document in which there's a lot of bipartisan confidence sort of framing the competition and what DoD has to do on its side vis-a-vis China, Russia, as well as other threats around the world. The product of both Democrat or Republican thinking, so I don't think it's necessarily seen as a partisan document at all. Since it's been drafted in 2018, I think it's meaningfully moved the needle politically in terms of the debate and in terms of capability development. Walk us through the key takeaways from your report, because you guys are asking for some refinements for the next administration, whether it's Trump 2 or Biden 1, to be able to sort of refine and improve U.S. strategy vis-a-vis China.
So, hey, thanks, Father. You're absolutely right. Both Eric and I worked for Senator John McCain, who beginning in 2016 was arguing aggressively in using the National Defense Authorization Act to direct the Department of Defense to look at a more strategic approach in the National Defense Strategy. Secretary of Defense James Mattis comes in, and the National Defense Strategy he ends up approving in January 2018 did exactly what McCain was looking for. It signaled the end of a kind of a 10-year-long process to shift attention in the department to the specific operational challenges posed by our two near-peer adversaries, China and Russia. This is over the 10-year period ahead of this. Both the Democratic and Republican administrations had done some work on individual operational or tactical or posture efforts in the Pacific, but they hadn't taken the strategic approach that Secretary Mattis's signature on the NDS did. It signaled that at the highest levels of the Pentagon and in the national security decision-making complex, we had adopted the logic that China and Russia should be the organizing principle behind our efforts in the building, whether they were capabilities development, operational employment, research and development. We had to fixate and focus on the issue presented by these near-peer adversaries. Erickson, my argument is that the last 3 years have only continued to show the challenge that we have with China, the impact of its malevolent actions in the region, and the recognition that the United States is in a long-term strategic competition with China. So as we looked forward, I think the core argument we made was that China has really made itself apparent as the organizing principle upon which we need to focus our strategic efforts. And so we make the argument that that China, because of its unique military and economic challenges that applies to the United States, China needs to be the explicit focus of the next national defense strategy, whether it's in a second Trump administration or first Biden administration.
Eric, one of the challenges with the NDS and indeed the administration's approach, and I think it is welcome, although I think we can all agree that the China that we saw between 2014 and 2016 is very different than the China we've seen from 2016 or even 2017 until now, and indeed even in the last year. the bellicosity, the aggressiveness, the wolf warrior diplomats and what have you have really manifested itself in part because of a Chinese calculation that the world is weak and we can take advantage, and the United States is weak, we can take advantage of this moment to sort of seize the initiative, not, I think, recognizing that it's strategically doing itself a disservice. Right? I mean, if it had bided and waited, it would have probably achieved its goals a little more clearly than organizing the world against it. Eric, can the strategy succeed if the president doesn't believe in it? Because there has been this question that for a great strategy, many people on the national security team working on becoming tougher on China, that becoming tough becomes difficult if the president himself is, for example, more interested in a trade deal, and that's where the focus has been until very, very recently. Can a strategy like this succeed if you don't have the president not just backing the strategy, but then aligning all arms of government so that you get that concerted line of effort in a competition where the Chinese are diplomatically, economically, militarily, informationally engaging across a very broad front worldwide?
Yeah, great question, Vago. I think you're indeed right on the macro question here, and that, you know, we're not just seeing Chinese bellicosity, as you said, aggressiveness in the military domain, but it's been in the economic domain and the diplomatic domain and the technology domain kind of across the spectrum the last, as you also said, 3, 4, 5 years. When it comes to this strategy, though, you know, this is a defense strategy. It's not the national security strategy at the higher level of the National Security Council at the White House. It's the NDS at the Pentagon. And so to some degree, the president's interest matters in any administration. But at the end of the day, it's really, I think, the secretary and his relationship to, you know, OMB, you know, where the money comes from, the resources, and then his ability to get his team in place and drive that strategy forward. And so as Mark and I say, you know, we've seen some success in the strategy the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, let's be clear here. This didn't just come about in some sort of easy fashion. It took many years, as Mark and I talk in the paper, of sort of trickling up from the services and from previous secretaries and deputy secretaries to get to this point. And now after this strategy was set in place, you know, it's going to take a couple of more efforts to really push this forward and get it right. You know, as Senator McCain actually established the National Defense Strategy in the FY17 National Defense Authorization Act, and that wasn't supposed to just be every 2 years or every 10 years or once an administration. It's supposed to be every 4 years. So you're constantly assessing your homework, and each administration every 4 years gets another bite at the apple. So I think success here is going to be, you know, to the next NDS and the one after that. Do they continue to reinforce and reestablish, you know, direct resources towards what Mark and I see as the central challenge here from a military perspective? And that's the China challenge.
Mark, you know, Bridge Colby was one of the authors of the strategy, along with Frank Hoffman, obviously Jim Mattis, and many other voices across the national security enterprise contributed meaningfully to the document. But one of the issues is the amount of attention that you have to pay on challenges elsewhere in the world. You may want to get out of the Middle East. The Middle East, for example, may not want you to be getting out of it, right? And so that's by some the fallacy of doing a full shift or a complete focus. Obviously, the Commandant of the Marine Corps is under criticism for giving up capabilities that may be useful elsewhere in the world, as he puts in his strategy a much greater focus on China. The argument going that, hey, look, if I can deal with this high-intensity anti-access area denial challenge, any lesser-included case will be something that I will be able to handle somehow. How do you respond to those who say that if you make the challenge implicitly China, A, you're increasing tensions with China, which I'm not necessarily sure is a particularly good excuse, given that their interest is very clear in terms of what they want to do with us. But more broadly, that if you make China the focus, it makes everything else that the United States has to worry about somehow less important.
Well, I'll take the second part first, and I'll say, yes, that is correct. If you focus on China, everything else is somewhat less important. I would also say that if you look at the long-term challenges facing the United States, you know, China is a revisionist power that poses considerable risk to the United States, and the magnitude of its economic and military challenges when combined are a unique thing that we really haven't faced, even during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, where we weren't facing you know, an economy that was, you know, on the same scale as ours. I mean, if you look today, I think China's economy, the second ranked economy in the world, and Russia's the 12th, and it's actually 7 or 8 times bigger than the Russian economy. Now, the Soviet economy was larger than the Russian economy is now, but the scale is there. China is the strategic threat. And yes, in a strategic document should in fact lay out your strategic threat. And the fallacy is when you say we can do a little bit of everything. Because the truth is, when you do a little bit of everything, you cannot muster the appropriate critical mass to handle the really big thing. And we are not handling the really big thing well in China. We're not competing with them. We're not competing with them in our ability to maintain military access. We're not competing with them in terms of the research and development that goes into the weapon systems that are likely to be used in the inside the first and second island chains of the Asia Pacific. And the reason for that is, despite spending nearly, you know, $709 and $750 billion over the last 3 years, we're not focusing our effort on countering our most significant challenge, China.
Can I add to that, Bongo?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think to build on what Mark's saying here, it's a question too of not just the priority now, but driving resources into this space when they've been put on hold for so long. You know, we've been spending considerable resources on tactical munitions, you know, like Hellfire missiles for the ISIS fight. We've been spending billions of dollars a year, $30 billion since 2014, to upgrade our posture in Europe after the invasion of Crimea, annexation of Crimea. So I think what Mark and I are arguing is that by making China the explicit priority here, it's kind of saying, you know, but putting China on the back burner for all these years and not investing in our theater posture and our munitions and the type of capabilities that are critical in this theater, you know, it's brought us to this point where the urgency now is in this theater. You know, we've made the down payment with the European Deterrence Initiative the last 6 or 7 years. It's sort of time now to catch up with those resources and apply them similarly to the Pacific theater.
Well, I mean, right. I mean, the big readiness push, the concern people had with the big readiness push was, you have more money than ever, you should be channeling that into the hardware, and then you can catch up on the readiness later. Whereas when the money drops, you won't have that money to be investing in that hardware and in filling up those magazines and what have you. One of the questions, and Mark, let me go to you about Taiwan, because one thing you guys said was, you know, sort of where Taiwan goes, so goes the region. There is a concern that the next couple of months, I've written about it, and I think others have as well, that the next couple of months are going to be potentially the most dangerous we've had in a long time, because the Chinese, you know, part of the plan is crack down on Hong Kong and then take Taiwan. And if the Chinese think that now's the time to do it before a new administration comes in, for example, they may want to deliver some form of fait accompli on that. How do we need to think about Taiwan? Because increasingly, over the past number of years, the deck really has tilted much more in China's favor to seize the island nation that Beijing looks at as a breakaway province, as opposed to an independent democratic nation. How do we need to fundamentally, you know, because there were holes in the Taiwan Relations Act, right? So how do we need to think differently about Taiwan if we are to deter China?
Well, first, I'll say you're absolutely right that Taiwan is one of the critical issues and one of the issues that Eric and I draw attention to in this article and in other forums. And what I'd say is, first of all, if an event were to happen, I don't think an event's going to happen in Taiwan in the next few months. I think the Chinese have a slightly longer view angle on that, you know, sometime in the next 10 to 12 years. But if it were to happen, the efforts that need to be made were 5 and 10 years ago. There's very little I think we can do right now to change the balance, you know, in the readiness of the Taiwan or the level of integration of U.S. and Taiwan forces in a short period of time. That opportunity came and went over the last 10 years. What I would say is we have to stop looking at Taiwan just as a responsibility under the Taiwan Relations Act, which it is. It's a responsibility for the United States. But we have to begin to look at it as an opportunity. It's an opportunity to highlight what a thriving democracy you know, practicing, you know, free trade and rules-based systems can look like in Northeast Asia. Taiwan's a great example of that. It's an opportunity to show the Chinese that we are going to you know, hold the line. It's you know, in terms of our agreements of the Taiwan Relations Act, but also against this kind of creeping Chinese authoritarianism throughout Southeast Asia. And then finally, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to show credibility to our allies and partners. If you're in Southeast Asia or Northeast Asia, Taiwan is an exemplar of the United States commitment to, you know, it is an opportunity for the United States to demonstrate its commitment to democracy, to free trade, to rules-based systems, you know, that the Taiwanese represent. So we absolutely need to start looking at it as this opportunity and something where we can begin to impose costs a little bit on the Chinese. The Chinese have done a very good job of creating conundrums for the United States. They've done a fantastic job operating below the level of war and get in achieving a lot, whether it's in South China Sea Island building or in their kind of pervasive cyber intellectual property theft over the last decade. To me, Taiwan's an opportunity for us to begin to impose cost on them, show them that their actions have repercussions and that we're gonna increase our cooperation with Taiwan, whether, and it's not just about arms sales, it's about training and preparing the Taiwan military. It's about showing establishing the kind of integrating elements, planning, exercising, joint force operations with the Taiwans that will demonstrate to the Chinese that Taiwan will not be a Hong Kong. They will not have the opportunity to pull it in, to create one country, one system in Taiwan, and that we're willing to defend the Taiwanese democracy and the Taiwan's right to a free trade, rules-based system that their people have continually voted for.
And just to add on to that too, yeah, thank you. You know, Mark mentioned this line we have in the paper about Taiwan being not just a responsibility, but an opportunity. You know, on the responsibility question, and you alluded to this, Vago, in your comments, you know, that's where I think an interesting debate has emerged. Bridge Colby, Congressman Gallagher, others have been talking about, you know, certainly under the Taiwan Relations Act from 1979, we have some level of commitment, but it doesn't go as far. And we've always had this policy of strategic ambiguity to not explicitly say and have this declaratory policy that we will come to Taiwan's defense. The TRA falls short of that. And so this debate has emerged, and I think it's overdue. I think we have to be very careful and work through it methodically and ensure that, you know, like anything with Taiwan policy, there's the bipartisan approach, and it isn't a fit and start with one Republican administration doing this and the Democratic administration reversing it. You know, I think Washington needs to be on one page on this question of strategic ambiguity and our total responsibility. But, you know, it's an overdue debate about whether we should go further than the TRA. So Congress is debating legislation now that would have a declaratory policy that would make it more explicit that we're going to come to Taiwan's aid. And I think that, you know, for me at least, you know, there's utility in this approach, but we have to also be careful to not just offer it, you know, wholesale. We have to also ensure that with that larger commitment of from the United States, Taiwan in its defense spending and its organization of its military and its spending on training is also doing all the necessary steps to you know, to be in parallel with the U.S. effort here in Washington.
One of the things, though, right to your point, Eric, I mean, I'm somebody who's been a long time and very strong supporter of Taiwan. I think what China has done is deplorable in terms of peeling every single ally away from China. The influence that it's used with American companies to shut down their offices and operations in Taiwan to effectively ensure that Taiwan, you know, has no friends. I mean, I was, you know, at the Singapore Air Show many years ago where, even though the Singaporeans and the Taiwanese had an alliance and Singaporean troops were trained in Taiwan, the Singaporeans covered up every single Taiwanese flag because that was the first year that PRC had a big presence at the show and they just didn't want to see it. And then began to, you know, unfortunately put pressure on AIDC and the large Taiwanese delegation that was there, right? I mean, so even old-time friends are willing to abandon their friends in the face of this kind of pressure. But one of the concerns that folks had, and friends of mine in the Bush administration would tell me this all the time when the democracy, the independence movement was picking up steam, was Taipei's sort of attitude that you have to defend us no matter what we have to do, so we don't have to do that much because you'll do it for us. And so that became kind of a problematic element of the relationship to a degree, which was like, well, no, we're not going to defend you under any circumstance, right? So, I mean, some form of clarification, that's what you're talking about, right? Like making sure that you get this balance right. Because at the end of the day, I think the Chinese recognize that there may not be as broad American public support for going to war on Taiwan's behalf against China, right? I mean, that's part of the challenge here, isn't it? To sort of clarify right. those lines.
Right. Well, first I'd say, Vago, I think you and I first met over a cocktail at the Singapore Air Show maybe 10 years ago. I'm not sure if this is the one you're talking about or not, but that's always a fun opportunity. I was a grad school student there back in the day. And Singapore is a unique example in the region where they have a longstanding relationship as another small island power with Taiwan. They send, they still send their forces there to train in Taiwan because they lack that training space every year. But also, like you said, they don't like to speak up and offer large grandiose support for Taiwan. So, to this point of Taiwan's diplomatic partners, and the role that Beijing's been playing and using their different economic relationships to pick those off in recent years, I think that's unfortunate. I think there's some things Washington can do to deter that going forward. But at the end of the day, what's most, the most important partner Taiwan has is the United States. And I think that it's that relationship that's really going to determine, and help determine the political future of Taiwan. And that's where the time and the energy of these two governments needs to be spent. Now, you also mentioned, just to finish, where Taiwan was maybe 15 years ago. And that was also around the time that President Bush was making his statement about, we'll do whatever it takes to defend Taiwan. I think he didn't mean to say that and reversed it later on. But that was when the relationship was in a more difficult political situation where Washington and Taipei weren't necessarily on the same sheet of music. I think in the last 4 years and now with the second term of this government, or President Tsai, Taiwan and Washington are much more aligned. Taiwan, isn't seeking or rushing towards some sort of independence movement. They want to find a way to work constructively within the current, organization of their relationship with Beijing and our relationship with Taipei. And so I think, what I'm really trying to say here is that we have the right political structures and political relationships right now for Washington and Taipei to really make some progress in the relationship like we haven't been able to make, maybe 10 and 15 years ago.
Mark, what is the right strategic approach in this competition with China? I mean, obviously, this administration has gotten very tough and has done some very, very thoughtful things, right? I mean, reconsideration of whether it's everything from student visas for those who are in the PLA or have PLA links to try to improve cyber security at the end of the day and to try to push back. But there's this concern that given that we're in an election season, that this administration wants to somehow lock the wheel and jam the throttles to make sure that there is a sort of an irrevocable collision between the two. What's the right philosophical approach to take with this competition? Because Eric and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, and Eric, I think, rightly said, and Eric, want to get your views on this, right? I don't care where a lot of things are made, and they can be made in China, and we can have very robust trade with China. It's just that there are some things that we will not want to rely on China for, and at the end of the day, this is going to take nuance and really thinking. From your standpoint, what's the philosophical approach to have for this? And then, Eric, want to get your sense as well.
So first, I do want to follow up on one thing on Taiwan. It sometimes frustrates me when people are critical of Taiwan's spending. As a democracy, they're one of the few, handful with the United States, Israel, and South Korea of democracies that spend consistently more than 2% of their GDP on defense. Taiwan spends about 2.5%. And frankly, that's a fast-growing GDP. They've been growing their defense budget 5% a year, and that just keeps them tracking with the 2.5% of GDP. So first, I do want to acknowledge that. And I'd also acknowledge, in the end, Taiwan really needs one ally or partner, and that's the United States. from that we'll grow the others. So, you know, if we follow Eric's advice on how to, you know, in a bipartisan way, embrace the Taiwan, make sure the Taiwan Relations Act really does serve to defend, you know, to secure the liberty of Taiwan, then I think we'll be in a good place. And I just want to make sure that, you know, the people recognize Taiwan does spend quite a bit on defense for democracy. To answer your question about the strategic approach of dealing with China, I'd first say one thing: we have to think long term. I mean, that's why we, Eric and I, focus on the National Defense Strategy. It really is the one long-term, you know, four-year-long strategic document. And in theory, if you prioritize China in there and then implement the National Defense Strategy effectively, and Eric and I have provided some criticism of that in some writings, then you will take this, you know, you will set yourself up well. So first, you have to treat China like China treats us. They treat us as their long-term strategic competitor. We have to treat them as our long-term strategic competitor. The second thing is we have to rely on the one big advantage we have over them, which is our network of alliance and partners. You know, we have, you know, literally scores of allies and then, you know, 100 partners around the world, and China has North Korea. You know, we really are in a position of strength there, and we have to leverage that. And to some degree, the way we've treated Korea and Japan on the host nation support issue over the last 3 years isn't how you treat an ally or partner. And so we need to get better at that. And then finally, I think what we need is, I'm putting on my Cyberspace Solarium Commission hat here. I'd say we need a safe and secure, you know, information technology communication supply chain. And what that really means is, we draw somewhere between 30 and 40% of most of the, you know, we utilize between 30 and 40% of most of the IT hardware produced around the world in the 8 or 10 different kind of ways you categorize that, whether it's microchips or printed circuit boards or whatever. But we only produce between about 0 and 10% of the world supply of that. So if you want a safe and secure supply chain, you have to figure out how to make another, you know, 25 to 30% of the world's supply chain secure. And our allies and partners, whether they're Scandinavian countries, NATO countries, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, can fill that gap for us. Now, every country I mentioned, they're up to Taiwan. I feel that we've worked hard to create that safe and secure environment. I think one of the burdens we're going to put on Taiwan, you know, as we talked about all the benefits earlier, one of the burdens we're going to put on them is that they're going to have to decide whether they want to be part of our safe and secure ITC supply chain, or they want to be part of China's safe and secure, or I guess safe and insecure supply chain. And I think that's going to be a challenging issue for them, how Taiwan threads that needle and works with us to create that. But I think long-term, you know, when you think about what we need to do in a strategic approach, it's get that safe and secure supply chain and what I'm talking about here, like Eric, it's, I'm not worried about where my sneakers or lawn furniture are made. I'm worried about where the chips for my JASSM-ER missile are made.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Mark. To add on further, I think despite the inconsistencies and the contradictions sometimes in this administration between the president and his staff and the rest of his administration, we have seen, you know, beyond the National Defense Strategy, which is obviously what we're talking about today, we have seen a pretty sophisticated and concerted effort by others, by the Robert O'Briens and Matt Pottingers and Secretary Pompeo and Secretary Ross and their staffs, to focus on the technology piece, you know, to put together a Huawei agenda, to put together a focus kind of across our government on military-civil fusion and why that issue is important and what we need to be doing to take steps even on human rights in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. In some ways, I think you're right, Bago, there is sort of a window of opportunity and some, you know, opportunistically maybe looking to lock in a certain approach, you know, beyond the election. But at the same time, I do think the administration deserves credit for maturing, you know, the focus on China beyond just the South China Sea, you know, and into the technology and economic domain, where a lot of, you know, from a Beijing perspective, where a lot of the competition has already been. Now, where does this lead us and what should a strategy look like? I mentioned the, you know, defense and economics and technology and human rights. We're never going to have a block, you know, like we did in the Cold War, where, you know, we more or less agree on a set of economic and military and technology issues. I think we're going to have overlapping coalitions where you have a coalition of countries that agree on Huawei and are taking steps on, you know, a secure telecommunication 5G network, where you have a coalition that's working on security issues as well. Maybe Japan and Australia and the United States and a few others are focused on the South China Sea or focused on the maritime domain. And maybe you have an even broader coalition that's focused on human rights and what's going on in Xinjiang and the Hong Kong piece and trying to collaborate and take steps. And so I think we're headed towards not a block strategy, but an overlapping coalition strategy, kind of a coalition of the willing on these various different issues as it relates to China. Now that's messy. That's not net neat, as we like to, you know, have our strategies dialed down to just two or three bullet points. But that's kind of the reality of a complicated U.S.-China relationship and U.S.-China competition. And then I just add and finish with, you know, I think what made our approach to the Soviet Union so successful in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, obviously it wasn't all success, but more or less politically successful here in Washington, was that it was bipartisan. You know, we went from a Truman administration to an Eisenhower administration to Kennedy and Nixon, and those administrations were able to sort of lock in a similar approach, a similar logic, if you will. Now, the grammar differed from administration to administration, but, you know, on the whole, the two parties and the country as a whole were heading in the right direction. Now, I think that that's what's going to be necessary. I'm not calling for a Democrat to win in November, but I do think, you know, from a U.S.-China perspective, it'll be beneficial to us over the next decade if we have kind of both parties at one point kind of commanding the, you know, the kind of the ship and driving us forward on the U.S.-China issue. Because I think Democrats, just like Republicans, have matured a perspective on China in recent years. And I guess to bring us back to where we started with the CNAS report, you know, a report that we did in January for CNAS that was commissioned by the Congress, it included, you know, people who were working on the Biden campaign and Warren campaign, people who worked for John McCain and other Republicans. It was a pretty bipartisan, it was a very bipartisan group. And we all came to a set of conclusions that, you know, I think we're seeing the administration sort of implement this summer. In many ways, we're seeing congressmen, both Republican and Democrat stripes on the Hill, call for and implement. You know, so politically in this town right now, I think we're in a pretty good spot on this. We're building a new consensus, but it's going to take some work, given some of the other politics that are at bay, to keep it together if we're going to be able to go forward and be successful.
I'm not very good at self-promotion, but one of the pieces I would commend is my notebook talking about why I think we need a solarium process to craft sort of a more concerted national strategy that serves as some sort of a bipartisan lasting template, to your point, right? As opposed to just looking at this from an NDS. It is very important to have the NDS, but it's also important to get that sort of broad national strategy right. We've got about a minute left, Mark. Why don't I give this one to you, and then Eric, if you can, briefly. There is a concern, though, that in the U.S. alliances have come under enormous stress and strain, and particularly with Japan and South Korea, but there have been also alliance frustrations elsewhere across the Pacific with the administration. The Japanese and Koreans in particular feel like they twice sort of privately increased the amount of money that they're spending on hosting American forces on their soil. And then the administration came back and said, well, we want five times as much money, and holding firm to it. And others, you know, mentioned like the $8 billion figure. These are nations that, you know, when you slight them publicly, there are always implications to it. How and then during the pandemic, the United States deliberately took actions to sort of stick both countries, laying off Korean workers, for example, or half the Korean workers as a consequence. How much of this damage is lasting damage, irrespective of what happens in November?
Well, listen, you know, we have a long term relationship with both countries in terms of being a credible ally, reliable partner. So this. You know, the angst over the host nation support, and I respect the Japanese and South Korean positions on this, in the sense that you know, a 400 or 500% increase in one review cycle is not appropriate and not how the system was designed. But I also believe that, you know, the number could go, you know, could and offers have been made to make the host nation support go up. But the broader issue is we need reliable partners in Northeast and Southeast Asia. Japan and South Korea have represented that, for both, in one case for the North Korean threat, that's in South Korea, and then in Japan for both the North Korean and Chinese threat. So we're going to need to maintain those strong relationships. And so I don't think we've damaged them irreparably, but I do think we've lost a little bit of that credibility that we banked over 50 years in that partnership. And we need to continue, Eric and I argue that we need to continue to push this our posture arrangements around Southeast Asia as well, whether it's in Australia and in the Philippines where it's more public, or in Singapore where it's a more quiet relationship. But in all these countries, the United States needs to understand that these countries aren't going to pay 100% of the freight for the host nation forces, for the U.S. forces that are there. That's not realistic. We are not a mercenary military that is stationed there and you pay 100% of it. That is not what the goal of the United States force posture has been historically over 50 years, and it shouldn't be what it is going forward. So I'm hoping we can get over this momentary perturbation, get back to reasonable costings, and resume the kind of banking the credibility we have in these 50-year-long relationships.
Eric, any last thoughts before we sign off?
Yeah, just that alliance management's difficult because it's worth it, and that's kind of where we find ourselves with these allies, and it's worth the squeeze. And I just read Mira Rapp Hooper's new book, Shields of the Republic, about, the role alliances played in the Cold War and that they could still play today. And it's an excellent, summary of why we have alliances and the true value we get out of them. And so, I agree with everything Mark said there. And these are just relationships, at the core. They're not just alliances, they're relationships that we have to continue to invest in.
And at the end of the day, it's not transactional and it's not about the money. It's really not about the money, is my sense on it at the end of the day. That's an issue, but they go much deeper and they're much more important. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Would love to have you guys back because I do want to talk, given how smart you both are on capabilities, to bring it back and how do we need to think about capabilities at the end of the day. Mark, thank you. Eric, thank you. All the best to you both, and look forward to having you back on.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago. Appreciate it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.